All right, good morning. Let's get started. First, I wanted to applaud all of you for getting up so early after a Thursday night in Vegas, the last day of the conference. I think it's quite an accomplishment that you are all here. So we've got 75 minutes. I wanted to leave a lot of time for questions towards the end. But if you have a burning question during the presentation, feel free to jump up. I'll try to see you through the lights. And feel free to ask a question as I'm moving forward as well. So let me start here by just some introductions. So my name is Daniel McCoskey. I manage the interaction design team at Surface. And the Sharpie marker is my primary tool, this idea of sketching and exploring. And I'll talk a bit about that later. Some quick history. I've been at Microsoft for about 5 years. I started out in what was then MSN. And my first role was looking at a future of MSN where services and software connected. We called this vision Longhorn Live way back when, which is now emerged into what we know as, you know, Windows Live and Microsoft Live. I then spent some time within the Windows group working on emerging markets. What can we do in Brazil, Russia, India, China, folks that make $5 to $15 a day? What solutions can we provide to them? And as a continuation of some of that work, I had a special assignment at Microsoft Research in Beijing. While I was there, I got a really interesting email from my mother-in-law, who I love and adore, but she's not necessarily the most technically savvy and astute person. And she sent me this really excited mail about this thing that she had seen on the news. And this is actually the first time that I had seen what was this Microsoft Research incubation being talked about in a more public way. And it was really the first time that she connected with me with anything related to Microsoft. And as coincidence has it, I connected with the team and have been with Surface for just over about half a year. So I imagine most of you have seen Surface and it's been about 9 months since we made that initial announcement. But for the few of you that maybe have been living in Antarctica or somewhere, I thought I'd show this.
Microsoft Surface represents a new bridge into the digital world. One that lets you shuffle the day's photos like an editor. And then send them through the mail. Surface is a new concierge in the lobby. One who knows all about planning day trips. One who knows every street in town. During the social hour, drinks will arrive at the table and put on a little show. Setting the stage for another order of chocolate pie or the decadent cheesecake. Thinking of buying a phone over your lunch hour? It's a whole new ball game. Now new phones practically introduce themselves, virtually bragging about their unique abilities. When it comes to music, moving through countless playlists and discovering new bands is a hands-on experience. Now everyone is a DJ, and entertainment is king.
So the part of Surface that I'm involved in is interaction design. Interaction design is a relatively recent design discipline. The term was only coined some, 15 years ago. The way I think about interaction design, it's really about behaviors and gestures and objects and scenarios. So it's really the underlying structure of the design. We have, a lot of other disciplines, and design disciplines are required to make a compelling product. So we have industrial design, we have visual design, we have audio designers. There's a whole range of skills. So I work as a part of a much larger team. These are a few folks that are on the Surface team. We call ourselves the User Experience Team, or sometimes abbreviated as Surface UX, which has the unfortunate acronym of this. And if you use the full official one, it would be Microsoft Sucks, which we found actually may resonate with a significant part of the population. But here's another video on that line that I'm sure many have seen, but just to present here as well.
One day, your computer will be a big-ass table with pictures of other people's kids all over it. Instead of actually playing with your kids, you could just look at video of them playing by themselves. And you'll smile knowing you've only paid $10,000 to do it. And if your mom has $10,000 laying around her house that she has nothing to do with, she can get one too. And then you can send her a postcard for free. That's the power of Microsoft Surface. Now consider this. Instead of using one of today's more popular compact devices to get directions to where you're going, why not use a device the size of a small car to do the same job? In the future, getting tanked with your friends is going to be a whole lot more fun because you'll be sitting at a table that makes something cool happen every time they bring you a drink, which you'll want to do over and over. Instead of interacting with actual human beings, you can just order your food right at your table. If you've still got any credit left on your card after you buy the table computer, why not think about a new phone or two phones? Because that's when you can do some really cool stuff. And remember all that money you spent on iTunes to get your favorite songs? Well, get ready to do it again, but this time for your new table computer. The future is here, and it's not an iPhone. It's a big-ass table. Take that, Apple.
SarcasticGamer.com.
Okay, so I mean that video is just amazing. It's one of those things you kind of wish you did yourself. It's a wonderful parody. This was done by these guys, Sarcastic Gamer, Doc and Lano. We liked it so much we had to bring these guys out to our team. So we brought these guys out. This is them in our building with our PR manager. There's a picture of our team back there. And I encourage you just to go to sarcasticgamer.com. They have some more recent postings of some of their adventures with the Surface team, and they're showing some early prototypes of some, a game experience. So definitely check that out. So today I wanted to address four things. I first thought we should zoom out a bit and just talk about this word experience. From my perspective as a designer, experience has become the buzzword of the O's, whereas brand was the buzzword of the 90s. And there are many definitions out there, and I thought I would just set a baseline of understanding of how we think about experience. So we'll start out with that. I also wanted to then talk about or briefly show a few examples from Microsoft's past and some current concepts that all relate to this common thread or theme of a natural experience or natural interaction. So I'll do a quick history on that because Surface does not coming in a vacuum. Surface is actually part of a longer progression of product experiences. I'll then talk about the vision that all of these efforts tie into and talk about the various attributes of that vision and then show you how that applies to Surface. At the end, I'll have three hopefully more practical thoughts or advice to those who want to design in this space of touch and voice and natural interaction. But today's presentation is largely conceptual in nature and in talking about the underlying motivation for why we're doing what we're doing. For those that haven't been to the sandbox, we have a few Surface units here. I really encourage you to explore some of our demos and to get hands-on. So let's start with experience. Before Microsoft, I worked for a company called Studio Archetype, which was a pioneer in this whole idea of what was then called experience design. Studio Archetype and Sapient kind of came together, and one of the a project about 10 years ago was a project for the AIGA, which is the American Institute of Graphic Arts, which is the premier design organization in the States, where there was the first time there was an articulation of this idea of experience design. And Rick Griffey, then the president of AIGA, wrote this formula and this idea that he said, experience design is form plus content plus context over time. And the short explanation of this was, if graphic design dealt with the form of an artifact, and then communication design evolved out of that, also including content and form, that the rise of the internet and new experiences allows for understanding how to design for people over time. So this was this definition, and it got me really excited, thinking about the ability to connect with people over time and in a richer way. But then, someone by the name of Liz Sanders made this statement: there is no such thing as experience design. For those that don't know Liz, she's the one that coined the term useful, usable, and desirable in 92. She's not one of the more known researchers and thinkers in design, but in my perspective, one of the most important. So getting excited about experience design and then seeing this statement was, you know, really interesting to me. And as I learned more about Liz and her work, she's really active in this whole fusion between design and research, and has pioneered this whole series of methods around how to actually involve people in the design process. And the way that she talks about experience, which to me I feel this is the very best definition that I've come across, and I'm really open to others if you guys have suggestions, but the way she describes experience is that it's a subjective event felt only by the person who has the experience. It's ephemeral, it's lasting only for a moment. Ones that we've had are our memories, and ones that we have not yet lived or hope to live are our dreams or our imaginations. And so her model is, this is experiences where dreams and memories meet. So fundamentally, you can't design that. And she added one simple modifier to this definition, which was for. You can't design experience, but you can design for experience. And for those of you that know conferences like Ducks, the name of that conference is Designing for User Experiences. So you can see some of this thinking influencing some of the dialogue in the design community. So I think this is really in line with how Surface thinks about experience, that experience is not something that our team owns. It's something that we have in humble recognition of the people that will be using our product and really trying to serve their needs. So there's been several efforts at Microsoft to create experiences that are more natural, that are more intuitive. And I'll mention some of them. So Bill Buxton, many of you may know, has been at Microsoft for some time, so we can now claim to have someone who's really been a pioneer in multi-touch and touch interfaces for quite some time. And he's actually fairly connected into our team. So there's definitely some great history and thinking there. We have the tablet PC, of course, is a product that had a premise that there may be a new way of interacting with a computer, one that relies on strokes and gestures and a stylus as a new way of interacting with a computer. In Vista, we have a whole range of speech recognition and voice technologies. It's primarily geared towards accessibility. But again, it's another way that we're able to respond to human input, albeit in an early way. And then, of course, we have the new Zunes are gesture-based. So there's going to be a talk later on this afternoon all about the Zunes, so let me not talk any more about this. But one of my good friends at Microsoft was the lead industrial designer on this. And we used to work together on a team where part of the team was looking at what we call the base of the pyramid, right? The global masses who largely are unable to access technology. And at the same time, we were looking at what we call the hardware innovation side of it. So looking at the very tip of the pyramid, how we can innovate on the high end. And so one of the projects that I was working on was this project of exploring a range of interfaces that would make a computer a lot easier to access. We do a lot of research in, you know, say, India and in China, and when people first saw a computer, they weren't quite sure what to do. There's clearly issues of literacy. Even the literate also have challenges just navigating this whole model, which many of us are probably very familiar with. Here are some explorations. This one actually stood out as one that people responded to as being really intuitive and approachable. And so we started doing some experiments of creating just a really simple way to launch a few programs. And we did some testing here in Egypt and some other places. And some of this work influenced what we did on Windows Starter Edition. But we also started to think about how can this idea of a simple interface apply to the higher end. So you can see this is a really old screenshot of a pre-release version of Vista. This is probably Longhorn then. And as we looked at the landscape of projects, we saw the application for this type of interface actually was much better suited to touch and direct interaction as opposed to a mouse. So one of the projects that this team was working on was a collaboration with HP on a really interesting PC called the TouchSmart, which launched with Vista. And some of that early thinking around a really simple and easy interface that we could marry with touch informed the design language for this that HP then took out and did a great job getting out into the marketplace. Also part of that team, the director of that team is a gentleman by the name of Steve Kaneko, who's one of the premier designers at Microsoft, who has been working with the Industrial Design Society of America, IDSA, to sponsor a competition to encourage thinking about a much more natural and holistic way of designing technology and computers. And so I encourage you to check out some of the past competitions and the current competition. But they created a piece, an inspirational piece, to set the tone for designers. And I thought I'd play this here because it's yet another vision that Microsoft has created around the idea of natural computing.
Design that is transparent,
intuitive,
natural interface, touch, pen and voice,
portable without weighing us down,
always available, always connected, simplicity in form and profile,
communicating and sharing in simple ways.
Extension of our personality and ourselves.
I envision a device that's every bit as creative as it is entertaining.
Start something.
So I've shown you a few products that Microsoft has shipped. I've shown you this one piece that's some concept vision. I have one more piece that's even more kind of futuristic and conceptual. So I think a lot of the ideas you're going to see in this next video are not ones that you may see in the immediate future, but I think that they present some important concepts about how we can have a better marriage between our lives and technology. So this comes out of the Office Labs group. This was a piece that they did around exploring what healthcare would look like with a better set of technology that's more natural.
Thank you.
Okay, so obviously some of that's, you know, pretty far into the future. The idea of taking, you know, a PC and, you know, having it, you know, X-ray physical objects is something that, you know, clearly we could do with a lot of work. But, you know, but I think when you think about the types of interactions that people had and the idea that surfaces start to respond to us and provide us as display surfaces that are flexible, that's really the vision that's driving Surface, and I'll talk about that in a bit. So I've shown you a number of things from Microsoft, but we haven't been particularly explicit about what is the common thread or theme behind all of these. And so the Surface team is starting to bring that together and articulate this vision. And I'll set this up by saying that I think we've all recognized that the last 30 years of computing, it's been about people learning the language of computers. Back in the punch card days, I mean, you really had to learn the language really deeply to have any, you know, type of interaction with the computer. And today, it's arguably easier, but we still have to learn the language of how these devices work. And often, that's a frustrating thing, and we talk back. This vision of natural experience and natural computing, the premise is that the next 30 years of computing is going to be more focused on computers and technology learning the language of people. And the language of people is those things that come naturally to us, that come naturally to children, which is touch and gesture and voice and any other type of human input, proximity, posture. This is my daughter, 4-year-old daughter, that's in one of our offices doing some tests on the table to make sure that her gestures make sense to how we think about the behaviors and physics models behind Surface. So simply stated, the vision of natural user experience, it's to deliver intuitive, seamless experiences that unfold through natural human input. This is beyond just the what you've seen with our initial demo, all the work that the Surface team is working on. This is what guides and leads and drives our work. And this is something that the Surface team connects with other teams at Microsoft to fulfill this vision. So originally, I was supposed to give this talk with my colleague and good friend, August De Los Reyes. He is a member of our team. He is what we call our user experience architect. So the next part of this presentation, I'll be drawing from August's work and presenting somewhat on his behalf. But I encourage you to keep track of August's work. He's very active in conferences and speaking, and very soon you'll see a clearer and deeper articulation of the underlying principles behind our philosophy. So just wanted to recognize August. So one of the things that we look at when you think about this vision, it's useful for us to look at the last 30 years and see how we've moved from punch card interfaces to our current set of interfaces. And there have been a number of inflection points as we've moved from fairly ancient ways of interacting with technology to ones that are starting to become more natural. As we look at the changes in those inflection points, it gives us guidance for the near future and where we may be headed. So punch cards were the original interface here for computers. For those that don't know, punch cards emerged in 1725 in France. They were originally used for French textile looms, and they were used for, punch cards that were used for a large organ player. And this became the model for early computer interfaces. Then, of course, we moved to CLI, command line interfaces, which was a pretty important, substantial jump in the way that we interact with technology. It allowed for a much more powerful way to, at any time, access any command. There was then a slight move into what's called TUI, or text user interface, which followed many of the same principles as a command line interface, but allowed for a more spatial representation of different options. And as you all know, we then moved into a GUI, and the GUI is currently the model that in the era of interface that we're all living within, albeit it looks better, it's richer, there's more there. And we can even see with our current interfaces attempts to explore, you know, another dimension of depth and more seamless transitions. And the experiences that we're seeing with here, I think, point to this future of new types of interfaces. So there are many ways that you can look at the changes of interfaces from punch card days to command line interfaces to text user interfaces all the way up to current GUIs and beyond. What August has been doing and what I'm going to present today is looking at these five attributes of metaphor, what our perception is of the system, what our relationship is, the nature of control, how flexible the system is, and how the system responds through behavior. By looking at each of these, we can start to see where natural interfaces are heading. So let's start with metaphor. Metaphor is about how we perceive the system. I'm going to use command line interfaces and GUIs as the first two starting points because they're, from my perspective, the most critical inflection points in our interface history. And we've moved from a command line interface that had a text representation to a graphical user interface that's more visual in nature. Now, the natural user interface. So there's two definitions I've given to you, or two terms I've now introduced. One is natural user experience, and here I'm using natural user interface. And this is a conscious choice to say that a product interface is just one of several aspects of a product. The interface is clearly very important, especially when you're dealing with screen-based media. But there are other attributes to a natural experience that go beyond the interface. Think of aesthetics. Think of all the various touch points that someone has. So as you learn about a product, as you try to manage that product, technically it's all interfaces, whether it's advertising or documentation or, but I feel that I wanted to separate out this larger sphere of experience versus this area of NUI or natural user interface. So in terms of the metaphor, NUIs rely on much more of a physical metaphor, not just a representational metaphor. In terms of the relationship of the user or the participant to the system, a command line interface is somewhat abstract. We use a text language to access commands within the system. We then get response and output that tells us what happened, but it's a fairly abstract relationship. The graphical user interface attempts to be more, is more direct, but it's still indirect. So we have this metaphor of, hand as mouse, and we've all become very used to and very nimble at navigating, but it's still indirect. We're still using the surfaces of our fingers to navigate through this space, but yet it's not quite close enough. So the idea of a natural user interface is that it's more direct manipulation and access to the system, that you're removing barriers of interface. In terms of how you get stuff done, or what we call control, a command line interface is really directed. You have to be an expert. You need to know what you're looking for. There are some things that you can look up to, get various commands, et cetera. But it's really the user is in control. In a graphical user interface, it's much more exploratory. You don't necessarily have to memorize all the various commands. For example, in Office, that will be talked about actually right after this talk. You can use things like a ribbon or other user interfaces to easily find and explore all of your options. And along this variable, we feel that a natural user interface is actually much more contextual, and that our goal is to provide a lot more focus, where we don't necessarily need to provide rich and endless options for deep productivity. It's really about focus and providing just the right gestures and tools and options for a very focused scenario. And then in terms of flexibility, there's amazing and high flexibility in the command line interface. At any time, you can access any number of commands. In a graphical user interface, depending on the application, you may have that same high degree of flexibility. But the options are more focused and more on demand. And with a natural user interface, our premise is that we're moving towards an interaction style that where there's less flexibility in terms of the number and range of any actions or tasks that you could complete, but that's an asset because it allows for simple and pure focus on the task at hand. And then finally, in terms of the behavior of the system, a command line interface is fairly static. I mean, there is scrolling text, so I guess you can say that's somewhat dynamic. But for all intents and purposes, the static behavior. A graphical user interface, of course, uses transitions and animations. You have multiple windows. It's more of a dynamic environment. And we feel that natural user interfaces are continuing this trend and will move into a much more realistic realistic behavior. So these are all of those attributes put together that we're looking at more physical interfaces that are more direct, that are more suited to the context and a very specific purpose. They're very focused, and they're becoming more realistic. So that's generic. That can apply to anyone doing any type of technology development in a space where they're trying to respond to human needs more naturally. So how does this apply to Surface? We've taken these threads and developed five core tenets that that we believe define the experience for Surface. And I'll touch on each of these briefly. You'll hear Jensen later on. Is Jensen in the crowd? Don't want to steal your thunder. I think he said he was going to sleep in this morning. He's going to talk about this idea of design principles and religion and how important that was to ensuring that the new office design language and interface stayed intact. And this is true for any product that has a focus on experience, staying true to a set of simple directives and simple principles that you can always gauge your decisions by. So these are the principles and the religion, as it were, for Surface. The first principle, and arguably the most important, is this idea of natural and intuitive. I mean, this defines the direction that this product is taking. The way that we've implemented that, and you'll see this in our demos, is we have something that we call scatter view, which is a way that we have objects just spill out on the table. You know, with a table, you have folks that can come around on all sides. And so the way that you need to design an interface in that environment is very different from a wall-based touch system where you have directions up, down, left, right. But it also gives us the chance to have objects and content behave in a much more organic layout, in a much more organic way, as if you had albums of music on a table or photos on a table and you're able to manipulate them. The wonderful thing about referencing that model is we already know how to use this interface because it references things that we're familiar with. So making sure that we're natural and intuitive is really important. The second principle, which is almost a counterpoint to natural and intuitive, is unique and magical. So it's not required that every design that our team does, that it has a very realistic immediate counterpart in the physical world, right? We should harness the power and the value of technology to augment our natural instincts with things that are magical and things that are really unique. So this example, this is the snowboard demo that was developed, and you know, Bill talked about it at CES. There's some interactions here where you can take this base snowboard and start to customize. You just have this gesture where you swipe your finger along the board and it flips, and you can think about both sides, and you have these decals that you can resize and move over the board and just have fun playing with this custom design experience. So that's not something that I could do in the real world that easily. I'd need, air guns, and I'd need to have a high degree of design skill, and I'd need all these things to do that. So it's fine to not be, totally realistic. Another principle, and I think this is one that's particularly unique to what Surface is doing in the multi-touch space, is that we are social, and it's about bringing people together. Too often, technology isolates us. We become, focused in our own worlds as we're walking down streets with our phones and our heads are down, and What we're really excited about here is the opportunity to bring technology into an environment that allows people to meet and to gather. I've been really impressed seeing all the connections that are made, even just as people gather around at the demo tables and they start to interact with various objects and start to get to know each other. This is one of our more recent demos. This is what we call Wine Bar, where it's an idea of, you know, having this more social and exploratory experience around the experience of wine. I don't drink myself, so I don't know the subtleties of this demo as well as some others may, but I encourage you to check it out and see how this works. Another principle for us is being aware and responsive. Part of this is about baseline performance, making sure that we have the appropriate degree of horsepower and to make sure that things respond in a really accurate way, as close as possible to the way that people want to move objects, etc. But it's also about recognizing things in the world. You know, most devices today have a very explicit way of interacting with them. Surface has a premise that you can put down an object on this surface, and it's aware of that object, whether it's a phone or a tagged object that one of our partners has been using. So it's not just a human-computer interaction. We can bring devices. You can use a paintbrush in our paint demo, and that we're aware of that experience. It's also about allowing users of Surface to do things that are contextual. So being aware of intent, being aware of when you have a really focused design system and strategy, you have to be really careful and tailored about the options that you give at any one moment. So being very careful about what folks are doing to provide them the best options without being presumptuous. Because I think we've all seen interfaces, whether they're autocomplete interfaces or others, that we just get frustrated with because you don't know what I want. So finding that balance. And then finally, we have a principle around being premium and authentic. This is something that, in my opinion, is something that Microsoft is getting much better at. It's not necessarily a principle that has guided us in our early days, but is one that's becoming more and more important. This is about that last 10% of the fit and the finish, the attention to detail, the craft that really allows for an experience to be seamless and beautiful. It's also about ensuring that the materials that we use in our visual design language and the interactions we create all have a coherent feeling to them. So, for example, right here, this is a very early exploratory version of what we call water. And water is something that you'll see in some of our demos is really important to Surface. It's this really pure and authentic material that we're using as a way to attract people to the table, as if when they're walking by and if no one's interacting with it. Water is something that will draw them in, and it's this premium material. So using this principle and making decisions about our visual design strategy and even our interaction models is really important. So there's a lot more underlying strategy and philosophy and how do you implement those and what are all the user experience guidelines, how does that affect audio design. I'm not able to get into those details right now. Again, look for August's future work and discussions around this vision and this philosophy. What I wanted to do was wrap up with a few more practical points about, as we've been trying to implement these principles and implement this vision of natural user experience, there are three points that I feel are the most critical to doing a good job in this space, whether it's touch or whether it's speech recognition, etc. And it's about a new way of thinking about conceptual work and prototyping. It's about recognizing that the content is the interface and what that entails, and it's about ensuring that you have the right skills on your team. So in terms of conceptual work, so this is just a quick snapshot of what we call our porch. Sorry, Tony, I know this isn't the best photo of you. But so, you know, in any design process, there's an exploratory experience where you look at many different options. You sketch out ideas. And so it's really important for us to put those up, to look across the various things that we're working on. But after we have those concepts developed, what we've started to do is create what we call paper prototypes. Now, paper prototypes have been around for a while. For those of you in the web space, you might have done this before, where you do rapid paper prototyping. This is a beautiful medium in that it's really easy to work in paper. It's really quick to iterate through concepts and ideas and approaches in paper. Many of us probably think that we can't sketch or draw unless you're a designer. I challenge that notion. I think that many people can express their ideas through simple sketches and visualization. The other wonderful thing about working in low fidelity, whether it's paper or whether in this case it's, you know, CD covers, these orange circles are like CD cases that you know, prevent scratching on CDs. We have magnets, we have laminated sheets of paper. In working in these tools and allowing for people to sketch on top of them, it invites participation from the people you're trying to design for. So these have always been advantages of paper prototyping and participatory design. So just to make it really specific, in this example, we were looking at ways of, this is for something we call concierge, where we're exploring various options within a city. And we had a different series of models, underlying models, or way to bring the interaction together. And so we put this in front of participants, and we asked them to complete a few tasks. And these are very, you know, generic tasks. It's not, you know, find this button. It's not standard evaluative usability testing. And we'd ask them to pretend as if their fingers could, you know, that these were actually live elements, and to talk about what they'd expect. And if they didn't see something that they wanted to see, well, just, it's laminated, don't worry about it. You know, it's not going to ruin it. Just write on top of it, on top of this. Give us your feedback. Let us know how this is working. We had pieces of paper on the side where people could create new objects and new elements to inform our design. So this allows a much richer connection between you and the folks that ultimately will be using your products and your experience. But for natural interaction and for touch especially, this medium is ideally suited for innovating and collaborating and for generating the best models. Because when you're doing paper prototyping for a website, there of course there's AJAX and RAA and other models emerging, but there's a different metaphor and it's all mouse-based interaction. When you're talking about touch-based interaction, doing paper prototyping is using the very interface that you're hoping to use ultimately. So the observations that you have around gestures and manipulations and intent, it's almost counterintuitive that such a low fidelity can provide that richness. The second point is that we need to move to an experience where the content becomes the interface. If any of you, I think we're all used to our current interfaces, those that, you know, perhaps use, you know, Outlook and web browsers and other things. If you actually count up the amount of real estate that's taken up with the choices that you have as opposed to the content that you're looking at, especially for those that have installed a lot of various toolbars and, you know, in your browsers, I mean, sometimes you get six of these things and all of a sudden a third of your page is taken up with the ability to manipulate content versus the ability to view and experience content. And we think that ensuring that you have a real focus on experiencing content, and I use content generally, I'm not just talking about imagery or text, is really important. So this is just an example of it, where a very simple example, where in San Diego we had a partner event where we invited a graffiti artist to come and just experience our paint application and just mess around. I think it was probably around Halloween, so they're doing some pumpkin design here. But the idea is that we've really minimized all of the chrome or to the very essential elements, just a simple color selection that references a metaphor of a simple paint dish, and a couple of toggle options that allow you to have different treatments and visual styles. And in this case, the content is the creation. It is the painting itself. And allowing that to live, and allowing that to be the focus, adds a much more, you know, rich experience. Another more specific example, this is not something you'll see in our demos, but something that I'll allude to, is, you know, photos are really wonderful in Surface, not only because the metaphor is so direct, but because it's such a wonderful way to share content. And, you know, we've been working with photos for so long now, we've started to forget that you, in real life, you can't do a two-finger gesture and resize actual photos. But, you know, one of the things that we've been looking at is how do you organize photos? This is actually a screenshot from our demo. So you'll see on the left-hand side, there's a couple of piles. You touch a pile, that pile will spill out, the other pile will go back. And that's one way of allowing these to be organized. We're now exploring some new interaction models that reference our experience with the real world. So, you know, we could have, for example, taken, you know, some container model where, you know, today we use folders and we you know, create a folder, pop some files in that folder. On Surface, we could have done something similar, you know, albeit not looking like a folder, but something similar where you create a container and then you put stuff in it. But as we thought about how you use photos in the real world, you start to look at photos, and the ones that start to come together, you just create a natural stack, right? You just start grouping things in piles that make sense to you. And so we have this interaction model that we're designing now where as soon as you put three objects close to each other in succession, we on demand build a container for you. And again, the container itself is a light stroke, just making you aware that we're aware that this is now a group. And you know, as soon as you take one off, it would disappear. And so there's other aspects to photos. This is something that Ali, who I'll introduce in a moment, and I were talking about last night, that there's all of these nuances in the real world that give us clues to the nature of things. So, you know, if we're looking at photographs and we know that a photograph is old, not only because of the content, because we're a lot slimmer and, you know, more beautiful than we are now, but also that, you know, the photograph itself might be a little more wrinkled or, you know, a little tinted or a little yellow around the edges. So when we think about that, you know, that's something we should consider developing in our interfaces. Perhaps we don't have date stamps and time stamps. Maybe that's something you can access, you know, maybe perhaps as you flip a photo, but that to communicate some of this idea of age through the subtleties and of visual cues, perhaps that's a more natural way of providing that information. And then the last point, oh, sorry. So to introduce Ali, so here in the front row we have my boss, Ali Vasai, who manages this user experience team. And this is a video that he's just casually talking about some of the interface that we've developed to allow people to switch between experiences. This is on the Surface blog. If you do a quick search on Surface blog, you'll find us. And I was thinking of playing this while he could stand up and do an interpretation of it, but I think he'll probably sit there and just observe. I wanted to show this video because this is the only thing that we have that's close to a toolbar or menus or start buttons. We've really removed all of that standard PC chrome and allowed the content to speak for itself. And we have in the corners is the closest thing that we have to a shell. And this video will introduce that.
Hi, my name is Ali Vasai. I manage the user experience team here with Microsoft Surface. Today, I'd like to introduce you to something we call the access points. So here we are with a Microsoft Surface, and we're in the lobby, and you've got what we call an app launcher. So it provides me a set of choices and different apps that I might be able to launch or play with. I'm going to scroll this and find one that I'm interested in. Let's say it's Photos. I touch it, Photos comes in, and it takes up the full screen, and now I've got an opportunity to play around with my photos and have fun. When I'm finished with Photos, if I want to go back to the lobby in order to select a different application or experience, then I need a mechanism by which to get back there. And that's where these access points come in. So we've got four of them, one in each corner of the table, and literally touching that will take me back to the lobby. We've positioned these access points in the four corners for two reasons. One is because we are dealing with a 360 UI. So as different people are sitting around the different sides of the table, they'll all have equal access to these access points. And then by putting them into the corner, we free up the central area in front of somebody for the application experience. So if I'm playing with photos or if I was playing a game of poker and my cards are here in front of me, it doesn't make, you know, this space has to be reserved for the application experience, and it wouldn't make sense for the access points to be in the center, so we move them off to the side. So everybody can have access to them, and they don't consume valuable real estate, prime real estate, right here in the front of a particular user. Hit the button, you go back to your lobby, and now you've got the ability to pick different applications to run.
And then the final point before I'm going to open up for questions is talking about what are the skill sets that you bring together for creating natural interfaces. The honest answer is I don't really know in any case how to generalize it. I will say that we have a really interesting and eclectic group of folks that we've brought together. We have, you know, folks with, of course, industrial design backgrounds because we have hardware and software. We have individuals that, you know, bring, you know, their experience in gaming and entertainment. So we have a whole range of folks. I just wanted to focus on design for a moment. So Surface design is kind of co-owned by myself and my good friend and colleague and this gentleman I share an office with, a really small office. We're always bumping backs to each other, Evan Hirsch. Evan will be at South by Southwest for those that are going, facilitating a panel there, so you'll have a chance to meet him there. So we've decided to create an interesting way of separating design. Traditionally at Microsoft, you have a product design team, one product design manager, and then you have a series of product designers who have a range of skills between visual design and interaction design. As we've looked at the design for Surface and have gone through a number of iterations of feeling some of the challenge and pain of simultaneously inventing as well as designing and creating, we felt that it was really important to have a group that was dedicated to interaction design. So that's the team that I manage. And that's the team that has the freedom to explore, again, behaviors and gestures and flow and progression in a space where there aren't a lot of precedents, and we have the ability to invent and explore. And my colleague Evan manages what we call the creative design team, which is visual design, industrial design, and audio design. So one place that has ownership and leadership around all the look and feel and the you know, how the experience responds. So we're clearly very integrated and very connected, but this is a new design model that we've that's emerged out of the requirements of inventing in this space. Now, Evan, I want to talk about this because Evan has an interesting background. He is trained as an industrial designer. He then made the jump into the film and special effects world, applying his skills around designing physical products to a larger space, and then ultimately into games. So he has this rich experience that, as we design Surface, brings a whole new perspective to how we design a device. So I'm going to shut up now. All the Sharpies are in. Thank you for your time. Really appreciate you, again, coming in so early, and wanted to open it up for questions. I think there's a mic. Thank you.
You'll kind of the various stages of user interfaces that you sort of described. For the most part, I mean, people do still use CLI sometimes when they really need power. But for the most part, what you kind of describe is a progression to better user interfaces in a fairly general sense. Do you see natural user interfaces as kind of being the next step for kind of in general for user interfaces, or do you see it being suitable for certain types of things?
You know, I think it's both. And on the touch panel yesterday, this question came up. And I feel that we don't have to use a touch or a STAG, speech, touch, and gesture-based interface for everything. I wouldn't necessarily want my, the pilot of my plane using a touch-based interface where his elbow might be able to swipe something and, So I think we have to be careful about making the assumption that every single technology and computer interface needs to be, purely natural and only responding to human input. In fact, that's one of our principles, that we explicitly don't design experiences on Surface that don't allow us to design around those principles. That said, I feel that as we mature with natural interfaces, especially with speech, which allows for much more directive and complex interaction, as those tools become better and we have more, less false positives, I imagine natural interfaces someday replacing a lot of our text-based or graphic-based interfaces.
You've mentioned that you joined the Surface Designing for Experience team roughly 6 months ago.
That's right.
And I'm not sure if you covered this during your presentation, but around roughly what time was the Surface design going through conceptualization?
There's probably a number of answers depending on what part of Surface you talk about. I mean, Surface... and if you go to surface.com, there's a really detailed history of how this unfolded. But in 2001, the earliest concept was developed as a partnership between Andy Wilson in research and Steve Batiche in hardware. Really, the concept emerged almost whole in terms of the underlying idea of a vision-based system that responded to natural input that had these really delightful focus scenarios. Of course, there's been a lot of time since then, and it's only been... fairly recently where this research incubation has been turned into a real focused product development effort. I would say that many of our models were in place by the time I arrived. But as we look at very particular experiences, using these methods to uncover the best model, there's been a lot of work done since I've been there. And we're really excited about this spring, we'll see our partners coming out with their first versions, and you'll see that out in the world.
Thanks. So far, it seems like a lot of the design and evaluation of these natural user interfaces has been pretty holistic in people sitting down and sort of getting their feedback and sort of very qualitative. And so I wonder, have you also thought about maybe a set of metrics, or is there some way to quantitatively measure the effectiveness of a natural user interface?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great point. I'm not the best qualified to answer that in a detailed way. We have a fantastic user research team that represents a whole range of research skills from qualitative to quantitative. I will say that we do have a series of metrics that provides that degree of granularity on how well we're doing. And we've defined a number of metrics actually based on our principles. So the question is, how do you measure natural and intuitive? Like, how do you measure that? Is there an objective way to do it? So we've come up with some really interesting ways to come up with a consistent metric along those ways. And some of it is we have a benchmark of how you manipulate objects in the real world and seeing how people respond to our experiences and how they gauge the differences. That's one way that we measure natural and intuitive, and we give a score to that, and we have a large range of folks from different ages and backgrounds, et cetera, to give us stability with that insight. But I think that's another talk that probably is great for the next mix.
Cool. Thanks.
Hi. I work for an e-learning company in the UK, and there's always a big emphasis about accessibility and, well, allowing for a really wide audience. That, up to a point, can be limiting sometimes to creating rich experiences. So what are the considerations for Surface?
Yeah. So to be quite honest, it's something that, you know, we feel is important. It's very difficult to have accessibility standards in a space where there are no standards yet. So I think, for example, when you look at the development of the web in the early days, accessibility did not have the degree of attention and focus that it does today. And we are in a standards-based world where it's a lot easier, and we can have this set of requirements and say, this is what it means to be accessible in these various circumstances. So it's something that, you know, is important to us, but it's, quite honestly, it's tough to really you know, figure out the details until we've really solidified the experience in the first place. Just stepping back, when you think about natural interfaces, it provides the promise of allowing reaction to people and how they interact, right? So whether it's speech recognition or whether it's touch or a combination thereof or other ways of interacting, I think my hope is that we're going to be moving into a space where accessibility becomes easier and easier to achieve through a vision of natural interfaces. But particularly for Surface, you'll have to wait to hear the specific story on exactly how that's being supported. But it's clearly on our radar. We've got about 10 minutes left. I'm more than happy to wrap up and let you guys get out a little bit early and explore some other sessions. But just want to give one more opportunity. Any last questions before we wrap up? Come on, man. You're not allowed to ask those questions. I think it's clearly harder. For those that are designers, I think you know that creating a really simple and focused and intuitive experience, regardless of the area, whether it's automotive design or web design or software design or print design, simple is hard. It's difficult to edit. It's easy to complicate things. So when you have a vision that is the fundamental premise is that it's simple and it's natural and it's intuitive, it's very challenging. You compound that with the fact that there isn't a lot of precedent when you're designing for another medium where there's been a lot of history. You have a lot more tools at your disposal. You know, when you're doing a form on the web, you have a whole series of conventions. You may change the look of those. You may invent new things through AJAX, et cetera, that break the model altogether. But you have at least a set of tools to consider. So in this space, I would say it's much more challenging because you're inventing at the same time that you're trying to create these pure, simple experiences. And the second part of your question was? Well, I think, I mean, in terms of process, those are the greatest challenges, is ensuring that the end product is delightful and meaningful and intuitive. I mean, there's a lot of detailed things in terms of process and methods, but the greatest challenge is to create something that is engaging, simple, and pure. All right. Oh, one more. Yeah, there's a rich space emerging. Again, I think we've kind of passed this inflection point where it's no longer a question, do we think about natural interfaces and the whole range of abilities to sense human input? It's just about what is the roadmap? How quickly can we get these in? How does it work? So all of the technologies that allow us to sense human presence and interaction are things that we look at. We're really focused on touch. is our, of course, our primary driving interaction right now. Personally, I feel that speech is a really interesting piece to add to the puzzle. It has a lot of hairy, difficult challenges about when it's accessed, when should it listen and when should it not listen, what happens when it, you know, when you have you know, false positives. I mean, there's all types of challenges with using speech, but I think that that provides, for me, I think that's the next step in allowing for more subtle experiences with primary and basic gestures, perhaps, married with a richer vocabulary of speech to create, you know, new experiences. There's really interesting things around proximity. We've talked about what could happen if you walked up to this table and it knew that you were, or it knew how many people were around it. What types of things would we do differently knowing that? Our vision system, you'll see with our demos, we actually, we're much richer than a basic capacitive system that only responds when you have contact with the surface. We actually have a vision-based system, and we can see slightly beyond the surface. We're not fully unlocking the potentials of that degree of sensing, but it's something that we're exploring on how we use that degree of sensing. On a panel yesterday, we had the concept artist who did the Minority Report work talked about a lot of his work working with brainwave detection and how we use that in our interfaces. So I think, you know, it's an exciting space, and we hope to add, you know, more capabilities. But right now, you know, touch is really primary. Another question.
In talking with your team, it's quite clear that you're keeping the development and the sort of the SDKs of the service fairly tight and very clearly focused on certain consumer spaces and partners and so forth. Yeah. Knowing Microsoft, at some point people will come out to the broader community. What's your comment on sort of where that's headed?
Oh man, I'm not sure I know how to answer that question. Because to be honest, I'm not the core decision maker in how in that strategy and how that works. I will say we're quickly coming to a point where you're going to see, you know, this spring you're going to see Surface out there in the world, and I think you're going to see, at that point, you know, there's just going to be a lot more public, you know, discussion and knowledge around what we're doing. So if you go to Surface.com, and actually if you go to the Surface blog, which today they're not connected, but MSDN hosts our blog, we actually have our, you know, the PM for our SDK really talking about how that's working. There's some examples of code and how that works. So we're trying to start that dialogue and get some information out. But as you know, launching a product is a really important it's a really important process, and paying careful attention to how we do that may be one of the reasons why there's not as much visibility right now, but hopefully that can change.
Can you talk about the difference between using a finger and using a mouse? You talk about touch interface, but it still feels very mouse-centric in a way.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot of differences depending on the type of technology you use. If any of you remember your days of first using a mouse, you'll remember of just you have to get used to that spatial relationship where, you know, you're not using the same physical. I mean, if you're on a 30-inch screen, you don't have to be, you know, trying to manipulate in that sense. So you have to get used to that progressive behavior and movement that you have with a mouse. And with Surface, it's interesting because we don't just you know find that point of intersection. We actually know how much surface area is being interacted with, and we can look at hand position, and we can deal with that in a really interesting way. So that allows us, again, when you think about what that looks like to our vision system and what you can respond to, it's just a much richer input than a position of a cursor on a screen. When you turn your mouse upside down, you know, it still has its orientation. I mean, just as a side little playful joke, we've said, well, you know, originally this was thought of as play table, as something that would be in the home. We said, well, what happens if your pets or your cats or dogs start climbing on the table? Can we do paw recognition and then, you know, scare them away so they don't start scratching or licking the table? So I think, you know, with richer sensing comes a richer ability to have a system respond. And I think you're seeing with our examples, again, very initial and simple and pure, and that's intentional for us to really not be overly sophisticated. But those are some of the differences I see. Okay, another question.
I know there's been some work done on stimulating the nerves in your fingers to feel like something actually has a feel to it. Not
right.
Just
haptics.
Flat.
Yeah.
You know, and that, there's something to that. I mean, when you're using but the tactile response is extremely relevant. And I was wondering,
yeah, you know, I can comment from, you know, our excitement, enthusiasm, and hopefulness that haptics will mature. Just personally, what I've seen is that there's a limitation on, how that can apply to a multi-touch experience. I think there's some pretty good and interesting technologies out there that allow for single-point haptics to be dynamic. And when we think about a multi-point, you know, multi-user type of experience, we need to ensure that haptics is really appropriate and rich for that, in that context. So I think you're right. I think that type of physical feedback is really powerful and really wonderful, especially when you think about virtual keyboards or, you know, other things where you're not just looking at eyesight to try to, and visual feedback to figure out what's happening with the system. So, I mean, don't expect anything in the immediate future, but it's clearly on our radar, and it's something that'll add a lot of additional richness to the experience. Wow. All right. I thought we were going to get out early. We've got 47 seconds here until I'm going over. Two more questions, and let's wrap up. Please. Spills on the surface. So because the surface is, it's not like a standard LCD, where if you press it, you know, it's really delicate. So because we use projection, we've made that top surface layer really durable. And, you know, we have demos like wine bar and restaurants. And so we've designed it so that, you know, you can spill drinks on it. And we've had some folks do that in the past just to demonstrate, hey, check this out. We've stopped doing it because it's just annoying to clean up. But so spill drinks are just fine on the surface. You know, you couldn't throw it in a pool. Obviously, it's not waterproof. But we're designing for durability on that top layer. And one more question back here. Yeah, it's a great question. Honestly, I don't know the answer in terms of a timeline of when designers that aren't within the scope of working with our current partners, et cetera, would be able to start experimenting and getting experiences onto Surface. It's an open question about how that could unfold. I mean, I will say in terms of internet content, internet content in general is really, I think, and this whole idea of services for the Surface Vision, it's really important. But really thinking about how to do that well is an interesting challenge for us to work out. And we want to avoid the immediate assumption that we're just going to just pop up a web browser and you're going to have all the standard PC Chrome associated with the web. But again, there's a lot of challenges with coming up with a new interface model for content that people experience with other conventions. So it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. It's on our radar, but I can't comment on any specific deadlines or timelines. All right, thanks so much. I appreciate you guys coming out.